It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat?
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want!
Welcome to episode 918 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off. It is Sunday, June 29th, 2025. I am the Solo Monster. 27 years ago today, Kane's 24-hour reign as WWF champion came to an end in one of the more memorable main events in Raw history, beaten by Stone Cold Steve Austin. Man, I remember when he got that three count, they blew the roof off the Gund in Cleveland, and that sign in the crowd, "Send help, the Gund is on fire." And it was. Hey, I've got a New Japan spoiler for you. If you follow New Japan, you have not seen this morning's show yet. If you don't want to be spoiled, consider this fair warning. They held a show called Tanahashi Jam, which is an awesome name for a show. They are, of course, halfway through Hiroshi Tanahashi's final year in the ring, but there was an IWGP World Heavyweight Championship match on this show with Hirooki Goto defending against Zack Sabre Jr. And there is a new IWGP World Champion. Zack Sabre Jr. wins the title for the second time, ending Goto's reign at 138 days. Goto's run was kind of the feel-good story of the year. You know, after all this time, all these many years, he finally wins the big one, and by all accounts, he was having a hell of a run. I was surprised to hear that they took the title off of him now, until I realized that we are less than 2 months away from Forbidden Door, which happens to be in London. And now it all makes sense in the, you know, realm of why they would want that title on the Brit heading into that show. I mean, they could have done the title change on that show, but they probably have a different opponent in mind for Sabre. I hope it's not Will Ospreay. Not that it wouldn't be a good match, but it's been done so many. I mean, it's been done like 1,000 times before. I hope that's not the plan. You know what I would love to see? And it's probably not going to happen because they're teasing something between him and Okada. But Takeshita. Takeshita challenging Sabre for the IWGP title, I think would be pretty damn cool. He does have a contract with them. I mean, if they wanted to put the title on him, that'd be awesome. I mean, he's got a contract with 3 different companies. I think it's just a 1-year deal that he signed with New Japan. But I would love to see it. Like, imagine Takeshita as the champion going into the Tokyo Dome, defending against one of the young guys who wins the G1, and then they anoint that person as the chosen one. But even if it was just a match where, you know, he didn't win, but, you know, he had a competitive title match with Sabre, I think that'd be awesome. I've got some news on the Tokyo Dome a little later on, and a major signing for New Japan. We also got to talk about Night of Champions in the first John Cena-CM Punk match in 12 years, and very likely their final match together. Kevin Owens was on Cody Rhodes' podcast and made some news. We got some All in Texas updates, and Hulk Hogan's latest venture. So let's get to it. If you'd like to make a PayPal donation, show your support, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on this show. First things first, I gotta give a shout to my boy Boots from the YouTube channel. He dropped an atomic bomb on the Night of Champions stream yesterday. Boots, I love you, brother. Thank you for all the love. We got the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, back on top. We got the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, always hogging up the main event scene. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, one of the nicest guys on the entire roster. You will not find anybody to say a bad word about Robert. We got the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Killshot, Keith Hart, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton. Shout out to the Green Pianist, all the way from Mauritania. Thank you. I will check out your video and get back to you, brother. I've also got a page for you guys to check out. It's called Wrestling Without Limits. At Wrestling Without Limits, all one word. The handle is the same on YouTube as it is on Instagram. Wrestling Without Limits is a cinematic figure federation made for fans who want a little bit more than just the wrestling content presented on television each week. Featuring the stars of yesterday, today, and tomorrow, WWL has all of your old favorites and maybe even some new ones, with weekly episodes of WWL Battlefront and periodic premium events. Wrestling Without Limits has a story and a superstar for everyone. I was watching one of their videos earlier. What it is it's a collection of still shots, but the way they're strung together is very well done, and it helps bring the action to life. It will never not be impressive to see the amount of work that goes into something like this. So check out at Wrestling Without Limits on YouTube, all one word, no spaces, and it should be the first result that comes up. Give them a sub and show them some love. Now, a programming note, so you don't forget, Raw tomorrow is airing 2 hours earlier than normal on Netflix. It's a 6 p.m. Eastern start time because they're going to be taping SmackDown immediately after Raw. So Friday SmackDown will be a taped show on July 4th. I will be going live 2 hours earlier than usual tomorrow. So if Raw goes from 6 to 8:30, figure I'll be live around 9 p.m. for the post-show review. And then things are back to normal, at least until the European tour, which is coming up in August. That's when my ExpressVPN is going to come in very handy again, just like it did back in March. Also, SmackDown, we got confirmation. Michael Cole said it himself during Night of Champions last night. SmackDown is officially going back to 2 hours, starting this Friday and every week thereafter. Ah, yes. You smell that? You smell the flowers are in full bloom. The air just smells a little bit crisper. It's great. It's a good day. So 2 hour SmackDowns are back. No more of this 3 hour shit every single week. You get a little bit more of your Friday night back. And you get me a little bit earlier on YouTube each week. So just be aware of that. WWE held its Night of Champions show in Riyadh yesterday, which was a very middle of the road show. It had its fun moments, but it was not one of their stronger Saudi shows. Actually, wrestling-wise, I thought it was one of their worst shows all year. Newsworthy, to the extent that we now know who will be challenging John Cena for the WWE title and who will be challenging Tiffany Stratton for her women's championship at SummerSlam. We have King Cody and Queen Jade, and we have a new United States champion, actually two of them. We have Julia, who beat Zelina Vega on Friday to win the women's U.S. title. But we have a new United States champion. I can think of worse things to be spending 3 hours of my life on, like SmackDown, but it was not a great show. I did nail all six of my predictions. Cody Rhodes and Randy Orton. This was their first match since 2013. Best match on the show, and it wasn't even the best match that they could pull out. We have yet to see that. I thought it was the perfect match for the two of them to have to set up a Cody and Randy program coming out of SummerSlam. There was a spot during the match. It was a Cody. It looked like a Cody cutter that was countered into an RKO out of midair. There was one person who posted a comment under the video on YouTube saying it was not a good spot because if he was going for a Cody cutter, right now, usually when he does a Cody cutter springboard off the ropes, he reaches behind him, right? He catches the guy's head on the way down. And this person said, well, if he was going for a Cody cutter, why did he turn? Right, and feed into the RKO. And that's fair, but you can explain that by saying that he wasn't going for a Cody cutter. Maybe he was going for a disaster kick, and he got caught. See? There you go. I just blew your mind. He was going for the disaster kick, but when he spotted Randy sizing him up, he was so stunned, he just froze in midair. It was still a great spot. They had a finish that was flat. It was kind of a flat finish. It did what it was supposed to do, which is plant the seeds of frustration for Randy Orton and show that Cody is willing to play dirty also if he has to, which he was not willing to do with John Cena at WrestleMania. And it cost him the championship. Because during the match, Randy Orton is the one, because really Randy was the one playing dirty. I mean, he's the one who introduced the steel chair into the ring. Referee took it away from him. While he was disposing of the chair, he went over to the corner and he pulled the top turnbuckle pad off. That was all Randy Orton, right? Cody didn't do any of that. All Cody did was take advantage of his misfortune. So it wasn't as if Cody was doing something underhanded. So I enjoyed the match. Now we know Cody Rhodes winning King of the Ring means he is going to challenge John Cena for the WWE Championship at SummerSlam. We're going to get the rematch from night two of WrestleMania, which was a horrible main event. And some people are speculating and hoping maybe Cody Rhodes is going to go heel at SummerSlam. Maybe the play here is not Randy Orton going heel, but it's Cody Rhodes going heel. Or, a double turn or something along those lines at SummerSlam. I personally don't think they're ready to turn Cody heel just yet. He will go heel. I don't think it's happening yet. I want to come back to this in a little bit, though, because I got an email from somebody last night that I think is worth sharing that ties into all this. So we're going to circle back around to this. We had Rhea Ripley and Raquel Rodriguez. They had a good street fight. I said that it was similar to what we got on SmackDown between Tiffany Stratton and Nia Jax in their last woman standing match. This was better, though. Of course, Rhea beats Raquel because she's a much bigger star than Raquel. And Raquel is in a tag team. She's one half of the women's tag team champions. She should not be beating Rhea Ripley. Nor has she been pushed on TV as any sort of major threat that would make you believe she would even have a real chance of doing so. Now, Rhea has been talking about going back after the women's world title, and they were also pushing that pretty hard on commentary. That tells me the direction for SummerSlam is very likely Rhea Ripley against Io Sky. I would love it if Asuka was involved, even if they turned it into a triple threat. I mean, I'd love to see Asuka against Io, but it doesn't feel that way right now. I just don't see anything else for Rhea to do on that show that would make sense, unless they set up a new story for her coming out of Evolution. You know, Evolution's in a few weeks. I don't even know what she's doing on that show. Maybe they set something up there. You know, hey, Nikki Bella doesn't have an opponent now, I guess, with Liv Morgan going down. There's always a chance. There's always a chance they pivot and they do that. Karrion Kross got his first PLE match since last year's WrestleMania. His first singles match on a PLE since 2022, which also happened to take place in Riyadh. He needed a good showing here. A lot of people have been rooting for him. A lot of people have been hoping that he would get a chance. He would get some more ring time. He would actually get a PLE match. Well, he got one. And he needed a good showing here. I thought he looked fine. Nothing terribly exciting in this match. They had a television match. He lost. Of course he did. I mean, it was Sammy and Saudi. And he was coming back out again to do a run-in during the main event. He was not losing to the man who lurks in the shadows every week. I don't know where this stuff came from about him not taking back bumps and that being why he's not pushed or has, I don't know if heat's the right word, but that was one of the reports. I guess it was Wade Keller. It was a report from The Torch. He took plenty of back bumps during this match. So this should not even be a story. I feel silly even talking about this. Story, though, is what I hope they can come up with for him now coming out of this match. Assuming the stuff with him and Sammy is basically done, and maybe it isn't. But let's assume it is. He is over enough, Kross is, with a segment of the audience. And he does get noticeable reactions. It's nothing overwhelming. It's not like when LA Knight's music hits or CM Punk's music or anything like that. But he gets enough of a reaction from the audiences in these different places. Even in Saudi yesterday. They should at least come up with something else for him to do heading into SummerSlam. So hopefully this isn't a one-and-done situation where, okay, they've been building to a match with Sammy. They did it. He lost. You know, back of the line. And he's lurking in the shadows again, doing nothing. Hopefully they have something for him to sink his teeth into. Solo Sikoa is the new United States champion with a win over Jacob Fatu, during which we had the return of the great Tonga Loa. Which, let's be honest, I mean, that's the real story here. And the debut of the former IWGP Tag Team Champion, Hikuleo, providing the assist that led ultimately to Solo actually winning the title. They never identified him by that name because that is no longer his name. He has officially been renamed Tala Tonga. That's what they said on the post-show. On that post-show, Solo Sikoa was asked what it would take for Jacob to get a rematch for the U.S. title. And Solo said Jacob would have to first apologize and come back to the family. Only then would things go back to the way they were before. I didn't know Solo Sikoa was also the general manager, and that he gets to pick and choose who he defends his title against. I don't think any apologies will be forthcoming. But the bloodline, which you know, felt like it was on its last legs with Jacob leaving and the Tongans were out injured. The bloodline has respawned with Solo as the champion. They've got JC Mateo. They've got Tongaloa back. And now they have Talatonga. It went exactly the way that I pitched it weeks ago. If you listen to this podcast, you know this. Hikuleo debuts on the show. He helps Solo win. You do the title change. And we have Jacob chase to get the belt back. Some people thought it was stupid to have Jacob Fatu, his first real loss, lose to Solo Sikoa, but it made sense for the story. I mean, Solo had to win. He never wins. He had to win this. But he won it with help. You know, Jacob is fine. Jacob loses nothing other than, you know, 5 pounds of some weight around his waist. That's about it until he gets it back. And now he's got Jimmy Uso on his side. And I said in the review last night, I wonder if they're saving the return of Roman Reigns for this and not for something with Seth Rollins. I'm not saying that he won't go after Seth. He should. He should go after Seth Rollins. Seth Rollins and Paul Heyman as well. They screwed him. Right? I mean, Heyman turned on him at WrestleMania. There has to be some payback for that. But I floated the possibility of Roman getting back involved here. And then eventually the Usos, they reunite to assist Jacob against Solo's army, because outside of Jacob and Jimmy, they're all alone right now. Now, maybe Damian Priest gets involved. Maybe it's not even any of the Samoans. It's Damian Priest, right? Because he and Jacob have had some interactions on TV recently. But then we saw on Friday a little backstage face-to-face with Damian Priest and Aleister Black, because Priest took exception to what Black did to Ron Killings. So now it feels like Priest is going in a totally different direction. But I could see it as like a War Games match at Survivor Series. You know, it's at least possible. You know, Roman Reigns comes back, Roman, the Usos, Jacob against Solo's army. It's at least a possibility. Roman got the role of Akuma, by the way, in that Street Fighter movie. He was officially cast, and shooting begins in August in Australia. The casting for this movie, I saw the Hollywood Reporter story. The casting for this movie sounds horrendous. I mean, it's not a knock on Robin. I mean, he may do fine in the role. But they cast 50 Cent as Balrog, Jason Momoa as Blanca, Noah Centineo as Ken, and according to the story, gay country singer Orville Peck as Vega. And then Roman Reigns, the pro wrestler, as Akuma. Or as the story said, Roman Reign as Akuma. Like, what a completely random selection of names. Who knows if we even get Roman back in time for SummerSlam? You know, if we do, it's probably for a quickie tag team match. Maybe Roman and Punk as partners against Seth Rollins and Bronze Breaker. Him and his amazing summer tan. Actually, that would make a lot of sense. Because I've been struggling to think, like, up until yesterday, like, what do you even do with Punk? Since you already did Punk and Cena, you already blew through that. What do you do with Punk at SummerSlam? And then they sort of answered that question yesterday. I get back to Rollins again, but instead of just doing a singles match, actually, that would make a lot more sense. You know, it's not as big as having Punk in a focused, like, singles match with somebody, but I think the idea of Roman and Punk, you know, and they have their own issues that they would have to work out on television, which can make for some good TV. But Roman and Punk putting their differences aside to be partners for the first time as a tag team. I know they were partners in War Games, but partners as a tag team. I mean, that could be interesting. Jade Cargill beat out Asuka to win Queen of the Ring. She will be challenging for the WWE Women's Championship at SummerSlam. This was the worst match on the entire show. Asuka did her best. She carried 95% of it. She took the majority of it. And it was like a showcase for Asuka more so than for Jade. And then Jade won. And she sort of botched the pin too, where she fell backwards and it looked like she may have pulled Asuka's shoulder up in the process. So not unlike the screwy finish that we had in last year's King of the Ring final with Randy Orton and Gunther. I just didn't think this was a good showing for Jade at all. And it didn't help that the Saudi fans were solidly behind Asuka, and they sounded completely disinterested in pretty much everything Jade did. I mean, there was practically no reaction for the finish. Just as anticlimactic as it gets, Naomi did not cash in her Money in the Bank on SmackDown Friday night, so she still has the briefcase. And the question now is, does she cash in to win the title before SummerSlam, maybe at Evolution, and then defend against Jade, or does she cash in at SummerSlam to screw Jade out of the championship? I don't think we get two cash-ins at SummerSlam, but I do think we get one. The only question is which one makes more sense. I floated the idea previously of Naomi cashing in early, she defends against Jade, Bianca Belair goes heel at SummerSlam to screw Jade, and then she realigns with Naomi. That idea is still alive. I like the idea. I would not put the title on Jade Cargill. The only reason I would put the title on Jade Cargill is if she immediately turns around and loses it to Naomi that same night. That's about it. Bianca has to be involved in this in some way because there are still unresolved issues with all three of them. So I think she'll be involved. Do they have the guts to turn her heel? Everyone's talking about Cody going heel. Let's just turn everybody heel. We've had a lot of heel turns, it feels like, over the past several months. So would we get a Cody heel turn and a Bianca heel turn? I don't see all of this happening. A Bianca heel turn, though, I think would be very welcome. I just feel like she would be a very good heel. She's been a babyface for so long, it would be fun to see her in the heel spot. And John Cena retained his WWE Championship in the main event against CM Punk. Not before Punk apologized to the fans in Saudi Arabia on Friday during their kickoff event. He knew he was going to get booed. They knew he was going to get booed. He did get booed. And then he apologized for his past comments, and it was like a switch got flipped. And instantly the fans cheered for him and started chanting his name. It was hilarious. One of the fans in the crowd was a man at the kickoff event, was a man named Muhammad, who asked Punk to apologize for his 2020 tweet where he told The Miz to go suck a blood money covered dick in Saudi Arabia. Punk responded and said, "This guy over here, he wants me to apologize for a mean tweet that I wrote 6 years ago. Hey, listen, legitimately, had nothing to do with Saudi Arabia," he said. "I woke up and I was crabby and I wrote a mean tweet to The Miz. And I apologized to The Miz. And sir, what's your name? Muhammad? Muhammad, I sincerely apologize to you. And I love Saudi Arabia. I'm not perfect by any means. Sometimes as human beings, we screw up. The beautiful thing is everything is a lesson learned. And now here I am and you have invited me to your country. And I am grateful to be here." And he also found the kid who tried to get a photo with him the other day. This was also a thing on social media where it looked like he kind of shunned the kid aside, didn't sign for him, kept walking, or take a picture rather. And so he made it a point to get a photo with the kid as well. Now, WWE aired the footage of Punk apologizing in the arena, not on TV, but in the arena on Friday night in front of the live crowd, in advance of his segment at the end of the show. So you can see why some people would look at this and go, okay, he did what he did because he was told to do so. And they wanted to make sure that he didn't get, you know, booed out of Saudi Arabia. I will assume that it was genuine and he has changed his mind about how he feels about things, which people do in life, right? Sometimes they change their minds as they get older. Of course, that tweet to The Miz was not the only time that he talked about the Saudi shows. He was on a Barstool podcast, I think even before that, and said that he would never do a single one of those shows. But as I've said before, the minute he signed to come back to the company in 2023, he signed on to work the Saudi Arabia shows. Like, this should not come as any sort of real surprise. Whatever his real feelings are, I don't know. Okay, I can't get in the man's head. But he said what he felt he had to say. Good on him. If you think that makes him a hypocrite, you know, because of comments he made in the past or because he once wore a trans pride t-shirt on Collision, you're certainly entitled to feel that way and call him a hypocrite. Me, I don't really concern myself one way or the other with whether CM Punk is a hypocrite or not. If he's being sincere or not, I don't really care. I will not lose any sleep over this. I don't care enough to get into a whole debate over it, as people were doing all week long on social media. I want nothing to do with it. I don't care. He did what he felt he had to do for the people that he now works for. Period. End of story. Now, as far as the match between him and Cena, these two have had some very memorable matches in the past, including one of my favorite all-time matches in WWE. That was a long time ago. It's 14 years ago. Punk's a lot older now. Cena's a lot older now. Cena's even older than Punk. This John Cena that we see in the ring now is not the John Cena that we saw in the ring several years ago. He is either physically limited now in some of the things that he can do, or he just is holding back because he doesn't want to get hurt. You know, he's committed to this retirement run. You know, he's not looking to get injured and fuck it all up. He's got movies to make, whatever it is. A lot of it depends on who he is in the ring with as far as how good the match is going to be. Cena and Punk always had a certain magic together in the ring. There is still some of that magic there. This was not one of their best matches. I enjoyed it. I had fun enough with it. I didn't think it was a terrible match. I'll take this match that we had yesterday over the shit show that we had with him and Cody at WrestleMania. So it was fine. It will not go down as one of their best matches, like I said. And it'll be a very polarizing match because of all of the interference. Because we got to a point in the match where there was a ref bump. And Punk was calling for a referee. He didn't get a referee, but what he got was Seth Rollins and his crew of Merry Misfits. They come walking out, and he's outnumbered. And even John Cena, you know, when John Cena realized what was going on, obviously his title is on the line here, and he's about to get cashed in on, he confronted Seth, and they started beating down John Cena. And this is where things started to get weird, because we hear Penta's music in the middle of this John Cena CM Punk final ever main event. Here comes Penta. And he comes out, and John Cena is getting his ass kicked in the ring by Bronson Reed and Bron Breakker. And Penta is doing his Penta dance, his Penta strut, in no great rush to come out. Now, he wasn't coming out to save John Cena, but I love Penta so much. So he comes out, and Bron Breakker goes after him, and they fight, you know, on the ramp, and Sami Zayn comes out, and they're fighting on the side of the stage now, and Penta does a stage dive out onto both of them, and it's just mass chaos. And you still got Rollins, who's trying to cash in his Money in the Bank, and he lays out CM Punk, hits him with the briefcase, gives him a stomp. John Cena throws Seth Rollins out of the ring in his own match. Seth Rollins is not even in the match. He never officially cashed in. This is John Cena's match, and it felt like John Cena was stealing a pin, like it was a triple threat. If this was a triple threat match, John Cena would have stolen the pin from Seth Rollins. And that is how John Cena beat CM Punk. I don't know that there were too many people who honestly believed it was going to go any other way. So this was their way of protecting CM Punk from having to take a cleaner loss to John Cena. I appreciate the fact he didn't just take a kick to the dick and get pinned, because that would have been fucking lame. This was lame enough. What you can't say is that the interference didn't at least make sense, you know, as far as who came out. Like, I understand why Penta came out. He's had issues with Rollins and his crew. I understand why Sami Zayn would come out. Same thing. So them coming out made sense. They were trying to just fight the bad guys off and, you know, level the playing field a little bit. But it was a lot. It was a lot. Was it overbooked? Yes, it was overbooked. And sometimes that's a good thing, and sometimes that's a not so good thing. I'm kind of disappointed that in what will likely end up being the last match we ever see between these two guys, and as great as some of their past matches have been, that they felt the need to have to fall back on this and rely on this. But it is what it is. That's how John Cena got the win. And now, you know, it feels like we're looking at Rollins and Punk all over again. It's SummerSlam. Now, the question is there enough juice left in that orange to even squeeze out of it? Because these two have been feuding since Punk came back to the company 2 years ago. Like, legitimately, from the first night in. Remember all the fan video, you know, in Chicago that night of Seth Rollins cussing and, you know, flipping out? From the day that Punk came back to this company, these two men have been at each other's throats. And we've seen them in the ring several times now. We saw them in the ring in the very first Raw on Netflix at the beginning of the year. And we saw them in a cage in Madison Square Garden. We saw them in the main event on WrestleMania Night 1. And Punk has been, you know, foiled recently by Seth's crew. That's how he got screwed out of Money in the Bank. And on and on and on it goes. And it's getting pretty old now. So is this what we're headed for at SummerSlam? Is the question. Now, there's also the issue of John Cena. And we had it in this match. Not the first time we've seen it, but a crisis of conscience. Cena had the championship belt, brought it into the ring. And then thought better of it. And he threw the belt away. And it almost cost him the match. So they're dropping little hints here of what we all know is coming, which is the repentance, right? The redemption arc for John Cena. It is coming. It probably is coming post-SummerSlam. Because as I sit here now, if you were to ask me, do I think John Cena loses that title at SummerSlam? Whether it's Cody, whether it's a cash-in, does he walk out of MetLife as the WWE champion? I would say no. And when that happens, that's when his second half officially kicks off. The second half being the babyface run that I think we all thought we were going to get this year. But changed when Triple H had to come up with this idea of, hey, why don't we do this with John Cena? Why don't we have John Cena go heel? Because The Rock is going to be in Toronto and Ari wants him there and we have to come up with something big, and this is what they came up with. And John Cena himself did an interview recently and even said, like, so much of what they have him doing is constantly being changed and they're constantly pivoting. And it just blows my mind because in the final, you got John Cena back for one last year. That's a big deal. And the fact that they didn't have all this shit just mapped out in advance, like, okay, for this one guy, this is what we're going to do with him. We got him for one last year. Let's storyboard this shit. Let's come up with something, a proper ending, a proper send-off for one of our biggest stars of all time. And the whole thing from the start, or at least since Elimination Chamber, has really felt like they're just sort of winging it. Week to week, it just blows my mind. But I want to go back to what I was talking about earlier when I talked about Cody winning King of the Ring. So we know it's going to be Cody and John Cena at SummerSlam. I wanted to read this to you. This is a question that I got last night from someone as part of the mailbag, but I'm going to read it here because it ties into all this. And I actually think the way that they have laid this all out is quite great. This is from Antonio in Lisbon, Portugal. In your Night of Champions review, you discussed this talk of a Cody Cena double turn. Yeah, because somebody had asked me about it, so I was responding to it. A Cody and Cena double turn at SummerSlam. And while I do agree it's probably a bit premature, I disagree that it wouldn't make any sense. It actually makes more sense character-wise to do it now, and I would like to hear your thoughts on this. Cody was humiliated at WrestleMania. As you said, he looked like a geek. And the man said the same thing on TV and has also blamed himself for dropping the ball and losing the title to John Cena. The point of the Randy Orton match was to show that Cody is now willing to do what is necessary to win. And more importantly, he felt the taste of victory in doing so. In the case of that match, you can argue that it was justified because Orton was the one that set everything up. Cody just took advantage of the situation, but that argument is what's going to be the crux of Cody's turn. In the build to SummerSlam, Cody calls attention to Cena not using the title against Punk, and that for a brief moment, he saw the old John Cena. He now believes in what CM Punk said, that the title has corrupted him, and it's his mission to save WWE from Cena's tyranny, save John Cena from himself, and make up for the terrible mistake that he made at WrestleMania. Fast forward to SummerSlam, and after the usual ref bump, Cena grabs the belt. And just like with Punk, he's going to hit Cody, but he takes too long and Cody gets up to his feet and both men are in a standoff. Like with Punk, Cena has a crisis of conscience and Cody tells Cena that he's better than this. Let's end this the right way. Cody and the crowd get to Cena and he throws the belt away and the crowd cheers. And as he turns to Cody, Cody low blows him, hits Crossroads and pins him. And the show ends with Cody raising the belt with his foot on Cena's head, a mirror image of how Elimination Chamber ended. In Cody's head, he did nothing wrong. Like with Orton, he took advantage of an opening presented to him. He did what he was criticized for not doing at WrestleMania. And from there, you transition to a feud with a babyface Randy Orton. who expresses regret and shame over what he tried to do at Night of Champions, not because of what he became that night, but because of what it did to Cody, who was supposed to represent the very best of everyone in the company. And you solidify heel Cody with that feud. John Cena, on the other hand, gets into his redemption arc where he recognizes that he got corrupted by his obsession to win number 17, and in doing so, he created a monster in Cody Rhodes, and for that, he will never forgive himself. What do you think? I actually love that idea. I love that idea, and I love the way that you explained it, because it does lay it out in a way that makes all the sense in the world. You know, if you were going to turn Cody Rhodes heel, this honestly is the best way to do it. Cody got a lot of shit from a lot of people for the finish of that match at WrestleMania and how it made him look. And even if you kayfabe it and look at it from a storyline perspective, he still looked like a geek, right? Doing what he did or not doing what he, you know, failed to do. And it's like he deserved to lose for it. And he got mocked and scorned for it. And so now he's come around to this idea that, you know what, I heard the critiques and I realized the mistake that I made. I lost the championship that meant so much to me. And he's just a completely different person now is what he's turned into. And John Cena, when he finally goes back to being a babyface, can look at it. And I like the idea of him having regret over what he's done. He feels complicit in Cody Rhodes now being who he is. This is going probably deeper than they may end up going. I think, as is usually the case when people come up with these theories, we may be giving this a little more thought than they end up giving it, but I love that kind of aspect of the story. And so it would make sense then that Cody would be the heel, Randy would be the babyface, and you do it that way. I really like that. I really like the way that that's all laid out. Now, there's one issue here. And I still feel like you need that other big baby face to fill the void left by Cody if they turn him. And this is why I've been of the mindset that they're not going to turn Cody right now. Certainly the talk of turning Cody at WrestleMania this year was just fucking ridiculous. I mean, you talk about premature. Now you can kind of feel the tide maybe turning a little bit. Some fans are getting, there are some fans who are already sick of Cody and just don't like him. But the reactions, there are certain weeks and certain places where you can hear those boos. And the reality is, until he wrestled Cena at WrestleMania this year, that just wasn't the case. Like, Cody fully had everybody on board. It feels like the cracks are starting to show just a little bit. And so if they feel like the time is right and we're going to turn Cody heel, and I'm still not convinced of that, but if that's what they decide, he is still the biggest baby face in the company. I mean, you could say Punk, Cody and Punk, whatever, whoever you think is number one, 1A and 1B, right? Cody is still the top baby face in this company. If you're going to turn him heel or shades of gray, there has to be somebody lined up to help fill that void. It is a very big void that would be left by him going heel. So who would that person be? Now, I guess that could be Jey Uso. Although that's going to make some people very unhappy hearing me say that. Roman is never around anymore, so you can't rely on him. He's strictly part-time. Cena, you know, even if he goes babyface again, we know he's done at the end of the year, and he's not full-time. Then you have Punk. Randy Orton is not the... Frankly, CM Punk is not the answer either, as like the top babyface face of the company. Randy Orton is not the answer. This feels like a real good time to elevate LA Knight to a spot like that, doesn't it? Because Bron Breakker and Jacob Fatu, those are going to be the guys in the future. But I'm thinking more in terms of the here and now. It's good that they have names like Uso and Punk that are super over, but it feels like a real good spot for Knight to help fill when he comes back and he goes after Rollins and his crew. The Seth Riders, as somebody dubbed them on the stream. I love that. On the stream last night. Rollins and the Seth Riders. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Even as it's become more accepted to talk about seeking help when you have a problem, and seeking out therapy is one of the ways to address those problems, there's still a stigma attached to it. And there shouldn't be, but there is, especially for men. Men today face a lot of pressure. Pressure to perform, pressure to provide, pressure to keep it all together. It's no wonder that 6 million men in the U.S. suffer from depression every year. and it often goes undiagnosed. The struggle is real, and real strength comes from recognizing that you have a problem and doing something about it, not only for yourself, but for everyone else in your life, especially those that depend on you. If you're a man and you're feeling the weight of the world on your shoulders, talk to someone, anyone, a friend, a loved one, or a therapist. Therapy offers many benefits for your mental health, from coping skills to stress management, teaching you the skills to strengthen your relationships and remove barriers to forming new ones. It can also help you cope with and overcome issues stemming from past traumas in your life, no matter how big or small. Some that you may not even realize are still impacting your everyday life. With over 35,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people across the globe. And many of those people can attest to how much it's worked for them, which is why BetterHelp has an App Store rating of 4.9 out of 5, based on over 1.7 million client reviews. It's also fully online, making it convenient enough to fit into your busy schedule. And you also don't have to feel committed to one therapist if you want to change to a new one. BetterHelp lets you switch at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Talk it out with BetterHelp. Sound Off listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/solomonster. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/solomonster. Unfortunately, Liv Morgan is not the only member of the WWE roster in need of shoulder surgery. Earlier this week, BodySlam.net first reported that Chad Gable is injured, although the exact nature of the injury at the time wasn't known. Gable was in a backstage segment on Monday. He confronted Penta, and the segment ended with Penta giving him his signature arm breaker. This was done as a way to write Gable off TV. On Wednesday, PW Insider reported that Gable is scheduled to undergo shoulder surgery in early July, and there is no current timetable for his return. Fightful followed up by noting that El Grande Americano is also injured and expected to be out for the exact same length of time. Yeah, it's bad enough that they lost Gable, but they lost Americano too. And he's their current speed champion, no less. He last wrestled at the June 17th speed taping in a win over Birdo. So best wishes to them both. That sucks. There was a podcast interview this week with Kevin Owens as Cody Rhodes' guest on his What Do You Want to Talk About podcast. And on that show, they discussed the topic of pricing on the independent wrestling scene. And when Cody worked the independents after his WWE run as Stardust, he said that he always wanted to make sure the promoter got his money back from his appearance. Owens followed up by talking about a certain ex-WWE performer who took a very different approach, and they censored the name so we couldn't hear who it was that he was referring to. But this is what the conversation was like. Cody said, "I agreed with your sentiment on don't rob the bank. Price yourself fairly so that you can keep going. My big thing was I would do the in-ring photos after the show. I wanted to make sure the promoter got his money back because I would be on the show with other ex-WWE guys or WWE legends. They would rob the bank. I knew that guy didn't get his money off of you." Owens responded, "I just remember specifically hearing about ex-WWE guys that overestimated their appeal just because they were coming from a WWE run. And I think, you know, blank, couldn't hear it, is a good example. Charged insane amounts of money, which he might have gotten a couple of times at first, and now I think it's safe to say that he has not been booked very much. It might be by design, maybe he decided not to." And when he mentioned this person's name, Cody basically did a spit take, as if he agreed and knew exactly, you know, what he was talking about. And then Owens actually brought the person up again a little bit later on. He said, "Again, I hate to bring up blank, the blanks of the world, right? They did stuff in WWE. They were popular guys at a certain level. They won some titles, everything. But their run up until when they ended up getting released and having to go on the independent scene was really nothing compared to the run that you had up to that point. You were the Intercontinental Champion. You were in Legacy with Randy Orton. You were working Triple H and Shawn Michaels in main events of pay-per-views. You had a great run, and you still approached it with no ego, not expecting that run to do anything for you on the independent scene besides having promoters' attention. You didn't expect them to give you $3,000 a match just because you won the Intercontinental title by disaster-kicking Big Show off the apron with his foot going through a table. Amazing finish, by the way. So, obviously, people started to play the guessing game about who Kevin Owens was referring to. Who the name was, right, that got censored out of the podcast. And people started bringing up Ryback's name. Because Ryback is someone, when you think about it, Ryback would fit that bill. Had success in WWE, got to work with, you know, main event talent, and even headlined some pay-per-views with John Cena. He left WWE, got released, whatever. And you didn't really see him blowing up the independent scene. And there were stories and rumors about what he was charging, you know, for appearances. So Ryback picked up on this. And he wrote a very lengthy response about, you know, his run on the independents and why he stopped taking bookings. This is what Ryback had to say. I was made aware and saw the clip of Owens and Cody, two guys I always liked and got along with. It's clear they were referencing me, even with the name censored. For context, I was booked solid for 3 years straight after WWE. My rate was set by my then-manager, Pat Buck, a promoter himself, and every promoter I worked with made money and got my full effort. Meet and greets, matches, fan time, all of it. What's often left out, I walked away from a multi-million dollar WWE contract. I wasn't fired. I needed a five-disc fusion and full right shoulder replacement at age 34. I was told not to wrestle again. I had nerve damage that risked paralysis if I continued. I had to stop taking bookings entirely. Why? Because my doctors told me for the stem cells to work properly, I needed to stop wrestling. I also made the choice to stay home and care for my dog, Sophie, who developed severe disc disease, had multiple ruptures and surgeries, and was paralyzed twice. I refused to put her down just to keep traveling and making more money. I already had what I needed. Sophie turns 10 this November, and every second with her was worth it. I poured everything into rebuilding my health and my brand with Feed Me More Nutrition. I've had 20 stem cell procedures and was blessed to regrow all five discs in my back. I'm now finally close to being able to return. So yes, I do feel the comment was a low blow, especially coming from two guys I respected and spoke well of. But I'm not bitter. I've made peace with it, with WWE, and let go of the past. This isn't a storyline. It's real life, survival, growth, perspective. I wish Kevin a strong recovery, and I send both him and Cody nothing but love, health, and continued success. Now, Ryback, his post-WWE run on the independent scene lasted 2 years. It was really August of 2016 through August of 2018. He had almost 50 matches during that time, so it's not like he wrestled twice and that was it. But then Ryback followed up on Thursday night with another message. I want to clarify something from my recent post regarding the clip with Owens and Cody. After speaking with Kevin, he confirmed the person referenced in that specific comment wasn't me. My name did come up in another part of the conversation, but not in that clip. I jumped to conclusions based on the name being censored and Cody mentioning working shows with the guy. Since I haven't been publicly mentioned much in years, I assumed it was about me, and I was wrong. I appreciate Kevin for the honest conversation. We always got along, and I've always respected both him and Cody. This is a reminder to ask before assuming, and I'm grateful the post brought awareness to my story regardless, as a lot has been misunderstood in the past. Much love to you both. I actually thought both of his responses were very rational and very mature. I thought those were some good messages there, some good posts, and a good life lesson as well. From Ryback. So anybody mocking the guy or making fun of the guy, which I know he has made it very easy to do that at times in the past, I don't think this is one of those times. I actually thought his responses were very good. Now, I thought, okay, if it's not Ryback, then of course speculation continues about who they were talking about. I thought maybe Braun Strowman. I don't know if the timeline actually matches up here, but I was thinking maybe Braun Strowman. After he was released by WWE the first time, I know Meltzer was claiming he was asking for like $10,000 per appearance, and Strowman later denied that he spoke to anyone about bookings, but I don't think he ever outright denied the figure. I mean, I know people that have asked for more than that, okay? So it's not like the highest ask that I've ever heard about, but that's still a significant chunk of change for one appearance, you know, for most indie promoters. But I don't know if the timeline actually matches up on that. So I don't know. You know, beyond that little bit of speculation, I'm not going to spend any more time on wondering who it was they were talking about. Other than to say that I watched the entire 90-minute podcast, and it was really good. I've never seen a drunken Kevin Owens before. He was very entertaining. Also, totally out of character. Wasn't kayfabe at all. Yeah, you see Dominic and Liv when they're out doing interviews, and they're totally, you know, in kayfabe the entire time. That's not what this was. Some things that I learned. Cody tried to get Abyss into the Royal Rumble one year, but it didn't work out. And Owens says that that ship has sailed for Abyss. He's lost too much weight, and the way he walks on those knees, it would be criminal, he says, for Abyss to get back in the ring, or for someone to coerce him to get back into the ring. I will bet you the Rumble that Cody pitched to get him into is the one right after he got signed, because I pitched the same idea on the Sound of. Just give him one cameo, right? He even owns the name. Because remember, I don't know how it still works in TNA today, but there was at least a period of time where TNA was allowing guys to take their name and gimmick with them. And so he could have been Abyss. You know, one cameo in the Royal Rumble would have been awesome. And it just never happened. But at least he's in the video game now. They just added him as part of that DLC pack with all the NBA guys. You can play as Abyss, and then you got Shaquille O'Neal, and you got Jalen Brunson, you got Tyrese Halliburton. I think the Great Khali is in it. This is quite the group. Quite the group in this DLC pack. But yeah, you could be Abyss in the video game. Hey, remember when we got him on SmackDown for a little bit? As AJ's statistics guy, AJ Styles was going around. He had like a stats guy with him, whatever his title, whatever they were calling him at the time. And they killed that off way too soon. I think we need Joseph Park on WWE television. That's what I think. He doesn't have to wrestle, but I was always a Park mark in TNA. I would love to see him back on TV. Anyway, we learned that Kevin Owens absolutely hates when guys use spray tanner, and he thinks Bron Breakker should be arrested for his tan. He was not a Bret Hart fan growing up, which just feels, it just feels wrong. I mean, him growing up as a Canadian wrestling fan. He says he was not a Bret Hart fan, even though he and Bret now are very friendly with each other. He was an Owen Hart fan, because he had an older brother that used to beat the crap out of him, and Owen was the younger brother in his family, so he sympathized with him more. And we also learned that Jamie Noble apparently still runs an e-fed with storylines and everything. Hey, you know what? Many of us used to do that. I did for many, many years. Made some online friends that way. Apparently Jamie Noble is still at it. The big takeaway, though, from it is that he has not had his surgery yet. So he said in the interview that up until just this past week, he was having no symptoms, you know, and even the doctors were asking him, like, you have no symptoms whatsoever. He goes, no, I feel fine. There's no pain. There's no numbness. There's no tingling. There's nothing weird going on. And only in the last week have all the symptoms hit him at once. So he's got numbness and he's got pain, and it's just all hitting him at the same time. But the reason he hasn't had surgery yet is because they wanted to allow some time for his spinal cord to heal up a little bit on its own. So that way, when he went in for the next, and he is getting neck surgery no matter what, but when he goes in for the neck surgery, it won't have to be as extensive. So with the symptoms kind of rushing in all at once this week, I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing as far as how extensive the surgery is going to be, but the plan is for him to have surgery in mid-July. So anybody who's been wondering, hey, what's up with Kevin Owens and how's he healing up and when's he going to come back? Royal Rumble return for Kevin Owens. We're not going to see Kevin Owens back in the ring for a very long time. Like, I'm expecting the sort of recovery like Randy Orton had with his back. Randy Orton missed 18 months. It may well be that long before we see Kevin Owens back in the ring because he hasn't even had surgery yet. The WWE Vault channel on YouTube posted a message this week. WWE Vault quietly launched 1 year ago. Since then, we've amassed more than 2 million subscribers and 1 billion views. Thank you, our subscribers, for your support, requests, recommendations, and when the situation calls for it, corrections. To make sure we stay on track, we humbly ask that you keep your ideas coming. To show that we're not turning a blind eye to some of the more popular requests, here are some updates. We have not found footage of Kurt Angle against Owen Hart or Hogan on the snake pit. I swear, almost every video that I watch on The Vault, there's at least one comment about, give us Owen against Kurt. And other people have asked about Hogan on the snake pit. So I've talked about this before, but just real quick. There was a segment many years ago, it had to be back in 86. So this is 86, okay? This is Hogan at his peak, not even 87. Peak, I mean absolute peak Hogan of his popularity was 1986. And he had a segment. It might have been, God, was it Rhode Island, Providence? I don't know, but it was at a taping and they did a Snake Pit segment, which Jake the Snake Roberts used to host. And I'm pretty sure Jake was still a heel at the time. And Jake gave him a DDT. And the fans in the building popped. I could just imagine the fear of God in Vince McMahon when he heard that reaction. Because Hogan was the golden goose. Everything was built around Hogan. His whole business was built around. His whole expansion was built around Hogan. Only the year before was the first WrestleMania. And so Jake DDTs this guy and everybody pops. And I think it aired on television locally in that market. It did not air anywhere else. And I find it hard to believe that it's not still in the library. So unless Vince was just so panicked, he, you know, immediately ordered the tape to be erased on the spot. There are other segments you will find online with Hogan on the Snake Pit. That's not it. If you find Hogan on the Snake Pit on YouTube somewhere, I guarantee you that's not the segment. So we may never get to see it, but they're constantly getting requests. And Kurt Angle and Owen Hart, I want to say that the dark match they had was a few weeks before Owen died. I'm pretty sure it was May of 99. There's a photo out there of the match, but they've never released video of it. And I don't think it has anything to do with Martha, because they've had stuff on The Vault before with Owen in it. You know, to release one Owen Hart match, which is probably like a 5 or 6 minute match on their YouTube channel, they're not going to be prevented from doing it by Martha Hart. It has nothing to do with Martha. They may just legitimately not know where it is. Hopefully we get to see it one day. But they said, we haven't found that. More Omni live event videos are coming. No, Mystico against Dean Malenko did not happen. I guess this was a thing where people thought the match happened. And we have some WCW cyber ring footage, mostly on green screen. The Vault it's become my favorite channel on YouTube. It really has. I mean, the stuff on, and of course there's multiple vaults now. They have the WWE one, but they have the WCW vault. They clearly have a page parked for the ECW vault, even though there's no content up there. It's only a matter of time. But I think if you go to the handle like at ECW on YouTube, there's nothing there. I'm sure that's where the vault is going to be. But one more note on the vault. They released an infamous dark match from Madison Square Garden this week with some ECW talent. It was Danny Doring and Roadkill, Amish Roadkill, against the FBI. Little Guido and Tony Mameluke. This is from 2001. And so this would have been just a few months after ECW, you know, basically shut down. And this is the match where Paul Heyman supposedly, famously told the ECW guys, you know, go out there and tear it up, right? Tear the house down. And they did. They had one hell of a 5-minute match, only to then return backstage and get chewed out by Vince and whoever else for having such a great match, because it would overshadow all the actual stars on the show. And none of them were hired at the time. I think all of them eventually were hired, but they didn't get hired then. Now, Heyman is a savvy guy. Paul Heyman knows the score. Even though he would have been new to the company at that time, he's a smart guy. He had to have known that that would be the reaction from Vince McMahon. So why he would tell them that, I have no idea. But for that reason, it's a pretty infamous match. Now, on the AEW side, we go from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows. I don't talk about the ratings much anymore, ever since they started simulcasting on Max, because I just don't see the point to it. But since I did last week, because they did a pretty impressive number for their Arena Mexico show, and Dynamite was way up. It's only fair to follow up with how they did this week, and it wasn't great. It wasn't great. Dynamite on Wednesday averaged 613,000 viewers on TBS. I think it was 736,000 last week. They were down more than 16% from last week's show. That's the second lowest audience total for the show since May 21st. The show also did a 0.15 rating in the coveted 18 to 49 demo, down almost 29% from last week, matching the lowest number for the show in that category since April 23rd. Compared to the same week last year, which also, as this week did, went up against the NBA draft, Dynamite's viewership was down 10%, while the 18 to 49 rating was down almost 32%. Now, of course, the caveat here is that they're streaming on Max now, whereas a year ago they were not. And we don't know how many people watch the show on Max because they don't tell anybody. But that was a steep drop-off from last week. Now, here's the update on All in Texas, which is coming up in just a few weeks at Globe Life Field in Arlington. It's going to be the largest attendance for a non-WWE pay-per-view in North American history. Right now, they're right around $19,000 paid for the show, probably a $2.5 million gate. It's going to be the third largest in company history behind the two Wembley shows. Right now, we know Jon Moxley is defending the AEW World title in the main event against Hangman Adam Page, or what we presume is going to be the main event against Hangman Adam Page. If they're not doing a title change on that show, it's very possible something else may end up closing. Kenny Omega against Kazuchika Okada, champion against champion, title for title. This is to unify their respective titles and form the new unified title. Timeless Toni Storm defends the AEW Women's World title against Mercedes Moné. The Young Bucks will take on Will Ospreay and Swerve Strickland. And as we saw on Dynamite this week, Ospreay threw out the challenge and said, why don't you put up your EVP titles? So, like, if you lose, the Bucks are no longer EVP. I don't think it means that Swerve and Ospreay become EVPs. It's like when Stone Cold became CEO on Raw many years ago. I think it's just strictly if the Bucks don't win, they are no longer EVPs. They've also announced a men's casino gauntlet match and a women's casino gauntlet match, with the winners getting a future world championship match. So those are the matches that are official for the show. They have teased that the Hurt Syndicate might defend their tag team titles against Speedball Mike Bailey and Kevin Knight. So that's probably another direction. This Wednesday coming up is the 300th episode of Dynamite, Dynamite 300, and they have announced the big match for the show. Kazuchika Okada one-on-one against Kota Ibushi, who made his in-ring return on Dynamite against Trent Barretta this past week. Ibushi, physically anyway, he looks more like the Ibushi of old. Not exactly, but he looks a hell of a lot better than he did the last time we saw him, and he was moving around better too. So we're getting a better version of Kota Ibushi against Okada here on TV this week. And the last time these two would have been in the ring together one-on-one would have been, I want to say 2021, in the G1 Climax final. So you know how the G1 Climax is. It's a grueling, you know, month-long tournament, everything built to Okada and Ibushi. And they were rocking and rolling, and like midway through the match, he did a Phoenix Splash. And Ibushi, whatever it was, a broken collarbone or a shoulder issue, he was severely hurt. And they had to the point where they had to call the match off. And especially for someone like Ibushi, you know, in New Japan, you got to call a match off. It's got to be something bad. And especially in the finals of the G1. And that was the end of Ibushi's New Japan run. He never did come back after that to the company. So it's years later now. They're both older. It's a very different Okada that we've seen. It's a very different Ibushi. I don't know that this match is going to be able to rival some of the past ones that they've had. But you've got Okada and Ibushi in the ring. You've got some talent in there. And I am looking forward to seeing, you know, what this match looks like. It has to be the return of Kenny Omega, I would imagine, here. You get him back on TV, he can come to the rescue. You know, he can save Ibushi. I'm sure we're going to get Kenny Omega on TV this week. Also on that show, Mercedes Moné is defending her TBS championship against Mina Shirakawa. This is a rematch from their Tokyo Dome match back on January 5th. And look, I know that the idea of Mercedes losing, even at All In, let alone before All In, seems crazy. I don't think it's all that crazy, though, to think that she might lose this match. You know, she was the one who attacked Toni Storm on TV this week and left her laying. So you couple that with the fact that if Mercedes is going into Texas and winning and becoming the women's world champion, I don't see the point in having the women's world title and the TBS title on her at the same time. And I don't see a great way to get the TBS title off of her without her surrendering it, because I hate the idea, if she wins the world title, of her then losing, but only losing the TBS title. I just think that's incredibly stupid. It would be the equivalent of when the Ultimate Warrior beat Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 6, right? He was the Intercontinental Champion and he beat Hogan and he won the Winged Eagle. And then let's say a couple of months later, Warrior went out there on a show on a Saturday night's main event and he only defended the Intercontinental title against somebody, Rick Rude, I don't know, and he lost. The WWF champion just lost, but he only lost his Intercontinental title, right? It would be so stupid. So I feel like you have to get that title off of her beforehand if she is going to win the world championship. Here's your in. Here it is. And now Mercedes is beside herself because she's been undefeated up until this point. She's going in here cocky as all hell. If Toni Storm plays a role in her losing, it's going to drive her over a cliff, right? And give her more ammunition to want to beat this woman when they meet in Texas. But you get the TBS title away from her. You solve that issue. Are they going to do it? Probably not. I don't know, but I would if I were them. Unless, of course, she's going into Texas and actually losing, which is certainly possible. I mean, if you were to ask me right now, here, I'm not doing my predictions just yet, but if you were to ask me, do I think Mercedes is winning or losing in Texas, I would say she's winning. But who knows? I mean, maybe she loses. Maybe she loses, and that's where the downward spiral begins. Now, MJF is going to be in a qualifying match this Wednesday for the number two spot in the Men's Casino Gauntlet at All In. He's going to be in there against Brody King, Anthony Bowens, and AR Fox. Mark Briscoe qualified already to be the number one entrant in the Gauntlet. And the number two entrant is basically the same thing. It's like the number two entrant in the Royal Rumble. What makes number one so special that number two isn't? So MJF is going to be part of this qualifying match on Wednesday. And considering that he and Mark Briscoe were cutting promos on each other on Wednesday's show, I think it's pretty safe to say that MJF is the favorite to win here. Especially since as of this moment, he has no match for All In. He did make a surprise appearance, though, on the MLW show this week. For the first time since 2020... MJF returned to MLW as a surprise appearance Thursday at their Summer of the Beasts show, which streamed live and free on YouTube. I was watching it in the background while I was doing some other work, so imagine my surprise when MJF popped up on my screen. He wrestled almost 30 matches there between 2017 and 2020. Here, he came out unannounced to attack his recent rival, Mystico. Mystico is a former MLW middleweight champion himself. He came out to address, I guess, what was next for him. And as he started talking, members of the Contra Unit faction, which was once led by Jacob Fatu, all dressed in black with masks on, they came out to attack him. And he took them out one by one until there was one last member who ran out and he low-blowed Mystico. And then he took off his own mask to reveal a Mystico mask. And then he removed that mask to reveal that it was MJF. And the mask was the one that he stole from Mystico at Grand Slam. So MJF took the microphone, and this was after he rained punches down on Mystico. He took the microphone and said that he's not through with him. He said they will wrestle again, and when they do, he will beat him within an inch of his life after he makes a mockery of Mexico, his countrymen, and CMLL. And then he did his catchphrase and he left. Apparently, he only arrived at the building 10 minutes before to maintain the element of surprise and immediately left the building after the angle. Now, unless the idea is for Mystico to cost him the match on Wednesday and then do MJF against Mystico in Texas, I'm thinking that they're going to want to save this one for one of two shows. Either, because I really don't see this happening in Texas. I think we're either looking at it for Forbidden Door in August or September, because I know CMLL is celebrating its 92-year anniversary at Arena Mexico. It's coming up on September 19th. Even consider what MJF said in that promo here, right? He wants to not only beat this man within an inch of his life, he wants to make a mockery of Mexico and CMLL. AEW got the first match. I know it was Arena Mexico, but that was an AEW show. I would think CMLL might want the rematch on their show. So MJF against Mystico, maybe even Mask against Hair on their anniversary show in September. That sounds like a plan to me. I could see that. Chris Statlander won the women's four-way match on Wednesday to fill the number one spot in the women's gauntlet at All In. She beat out Willow Nightingale, Thunder Rosa, and Athena. It was good to see Athena wrestling on Dynamite. It's just too bad the match wasn't all that great. In a social media video on Thursday, Thunder Rosa issued a challenge to Athena to a Ring of Honor Women's World title match for Friday, July 11th in Arlington. That's the night before All In at Supercard of Honor. Athena has, I don't believe, responded to her challenge as of yet, but she will, and the match will happen on that show. Athena may not have won the qualifying match to be number one in the women's gauntlet, but that women's gauntlet may be her only way on that show. Hopefully she at least ends up in the gauntlet in some later spot. And then there's another thing to consider here as we are heading into this big stadium show in Texas. I cannot imagine that Adam Copeland is not going to be on that show. And if he is going to be on the All In card, you would think that this week, right, Dynamite 300 would be the night for him to return. Or they could save his return for Collision 100, because it's also the 100th episode of Collision this week coming up. And FTR is going to be wrestling the Outrunners on that show. They're actually taping the show the same night as Dynamite 300, so it's kind of like it's all Dynamite 300, basically. Last we saw Copeland, he was left for dead by FTR, so it would make sense for him to return on that show, maybe, you know, after their match. The question then is, what does he do at All In? Like, who does he tag with against FTR in Texas? Because Christian Cage is occupied. He's got his own story with Nick Wayne and the Patriarchy. And reportedly, Christian himself is the one who told, you know, Tony Khan, this story still has legs to it. I want to build things up a little bit more, you know, with him and Nick Wayne, which is the right move to make. Right, they could always save a Copeland Christian reunion for All Out, which is in Toronto in September. That would give them a little more time to build to it, and even that might be too soon for a reunion, depending on when they want to do the blow off between Christian and Nick Wayne. Because right now they're still together. You know, Nick is his son, right? I mean, this story has been going on for a while now. So you save the Copeland and Christian reunion for down the road. Of course they're going to do it. Tony Khan is probably salivating at the idea to put the tag team titles on these two guys. Texas would be ridiculous because it's far too soon. All Out, even All Out, I'm not sure if even that would be the right time for it. So Copeland and who? Take your pick. Copeland and someone against FTR. Well, you know what? I guess FTR has had issues with Daniel Garcia, right? Copeland and Garcia against FTR. It doesn't really excite me, but I mean, I guess you can do it. But I mentioned, you know, Nick Wayne is Christian's son, right? Bodyslam.net, I have to mention that this is so ridiculous. Bodyslam.net had a report claiming that not only does AEW have women's tag team belts sitting on a shelf waiting to be unveiled, which should be a shock to absolutely no one, they've had them there for a year now, right alongside another set of tag team titles, a set of father and son tag team titles. Intergenerational tag belts have been made. I can't be the only one when I first read this report who read that as intergalactic. Like, you know what? I wouldn't even be surprised at this point. We make so many jokes about how many fucking belts there are. I would put nothing past Tony Khan. I would not at all be surprised if we got intergalactic tag team belts in AEW, right? That's the next dimension that we're going to explore here. It's just so ridiculous. Father and son title. I cannot even think of more than a couple of possible father and son pairings Why would we need father and son titles? That sounds like something created specifically for Christian and Nick Wayne. Like as a gimmick, not as actual titles that would be defended by other people, because that would just be one of the dumbest things they've ever done. It would make more sense to have intergender tag team titles before they did father and son tag team titles. Right? I mean, Taz ain't getting back in the ring. We're not about to see Taz and Hook winning tag team gold. Billy Gunn has two sons in the company, neither of whom have wrestled since February. He's been running around with Anthony Bowens, who isn't even his real son. What other father and son pairings are we looking at here? Unless we're looking at poor Lantis Jr. and his father, who got fucking booed out of Arena Mexico 2 weeks ago. I can't think of anybody else. Today's episode is sponsored by Factor. We just had our first heat wave of the summer here. I could have cooked an egg on the floor if I wanted to outside, but that would be disgusting. You know what's not disgusting? It's actually the exact opposite. Factor meals. They're chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Factor meals arrive fresh and ready to eat, making them perfect for any active lifestyle. You don't want to be slaving over a hot stove when you could spend more of your time outside enjoying the summer weather. With 45 weekly menu options, you can pick gourmet meals that fit your goals. Choose from Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and more. Factor powers your day with nutritious breakfasts, on-the-go lunches, premium dinners, and I don't know about you, but my personal favorite, guilt-free snacks and desserts. Enjoy more this summer. If you want all the flavor without the fuss, Factor's got you covered. One of my favorite meals that I've had from Factor, it was just in the last few months, actually, and I've had some really good ones in the past, but there were two. One was the Ropa Vieja chicken thigh bowl, and the other, and my number one, was the sesame teriyaki filet mignon. If I spend 2 minutes trying to make anything, it's not coming out as good as this, okay? I could tell you that. So it's pretty cool that I could eat healthier while actually enjoying what it is that I'm eating. And I don't have to feel guilty after I'm done. Plus, you know, I'm streaming almost every night at this point, or it feels that way. And I'm watching so much wrestling every week. It's really convenient for me to be able to just heat it up in 2 minutes flat and have dinner. Just like that. Factor takes care of the hard part. Let them take care of it for you too, with this exclusive offer for Sound Off listeners. Get started at factormeals.com/solomonster50off and use code solomonster50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. That's code solomonster50off at factormeals.com/solomonster50off for 50% off plus free shipping. factormeals.com/solomonster50off. I mentioned earlier that there was a major signing for New Japan Pro Wrestling. Aaron Wolf, the 2021 Olympic gold medalist in judo at 220 pounds and a lifelong pro wrestling fan, became the biggest signing in many, many years by a Japanese wrestling company this week. The 29-year-old signed a deal with New Japan Pro Wrestling and will debut with his very first pro wrestling match at Wrestle Kingdom 20 on January 4th at the Tokyo Dome. As such, it was also announced this week per Tokyo Sports that this, and this is a pretty big deal, that TV Asahi, one of the biggest TV broadcasters in all of Japan, will be airing the entirety of Wrestle Kingdom Live, which will not only feature Aaron Wolf's debut, but the final match of Hiroshi Tanahashi's career. Usually they just air like an edited version of the show with a few select matches. This will be the first time that TV Asahi has aired a January 4th Tokyo Dome show live since 2004. Back then it wasn't even called Wrestle Kingdom yet. It was called Wrestling World, and it was headlined by a Shinsuke Nakamura title unification match against Yoshihiro Takayama. There was also a Bob Sapp match on that card. Bob Sapp at the time was a huge attraction in Japan. So that's huge. It's going to give New Japan huge exposure in a way that they have not had in many years. So this is a chance for them to not only, you know, hopefully make a new star right out of the gate with this guy. And he's a wild card here because we don't know how good he's going to look in the ring, right? It's his first match, but he's a mainstream celebrity in Japan. You hope they can hit a home run with him, but also expose new fans to some of the young guys that they've been trying to push to lead the charge for New Japan going forward. because they've lost so many big names. I mean, Okada and Ospreay and Naito recently, and Tanahashi is retiring. They need to make stars. If this guy takes to this quickly, you know, maybe he could be that Kurt Angle or Brock Lesnar type for them, who picks it up quickly and can be their new top star. Tanahashi pushed that Wolf would be the first Japanese Olympic gold medalist to become a pro wrestler. Bushiroad owner Takaki Kidani at the press conference said that as a sports fan, it was an incredible sight to see Tanahashi and Wolf sitting together and push Wrestle Kingdom as the end of one era and the beginning of another. Wolf said that he had offers from New Japan and from a much larger international promotion, which was obviously WWE or AEW. And he said that he asked Okada which offer he should take. And Okada told him, look, if you want to be the best wrestler that you could be, New Japan is the place for you to start your career. And Wolf said that he started training just this month. Tanahashi said that while he would not be living with the rest of the Young Lions, he would be training with them in their dojo and attending events prior to his debut. On this week's installment...
Real American Bullshit.
Of Real American Bullshit.
Oh, you got me, brother.
On Monday, the esteemed New York Post, who tweeted out a link recently to a story about the rise of the New York Order with a picture of the New World Order. It was up for a while before they took the tweet down. See, this is what happens when you have AI writing your headlines for you. The New York Post ran an exclusive on Hulk Hogan opening a $7 million bar in New York City opposite his spiritual home of Madison Square Garden. It says, Hulk Hogan is opening a huge 9,000 square foot $7 million bar opposite Madison Square Garden, Page Six has learned. Anyone who knows anything about WWE wrestling knows that the Garden is central to the Hogan myth. He made his WWE debut there in 1979. He won his first WWE championship there by defeating the Iron Sheik in 1984, headlined WrestleMania 1 there in 1985, and tag-teamed with the Ultimate Warrior there at the SummerSlam of 1991. Holy Brett. The SummerSlam of 1991, beating Sergeant Slaught, General... I swear to God, that's what it said. Sergeant Slaught. The fuck does that even mean? Sergeant Slaught, General Adnan, and Colonel Mustafa, as well as many other career highlights. Now we're told the ring legend is opening the sports bar to be called Slam, which will have a wall of windows facing the famed arena. We're told the spot, which is owned by New York nightlife vet Rich Rosen, will be filled with Hogan memorabilia and will have screens playing the 12-time world champion's greatest moments. It'll also serve as Hogan's own, it will also serve Hogan's own beer brand, Real American Beer, and we're told Hogan, who lives in Florida, will be a regular fixture at the Midtown spot. Slam is being decked out to look like the inside of the famed arena, complete with a jumbotron. Rosen told Page Six that after he found the venue at 461 8th Avenue on the corner of 31st Street, he sought out the wrestler because of his long and storied connection with the Garden. He went so far as to attend an autograph... But wait, let me just say this. The spelling in this article is atrocious. It is atrocious. Who wrote that? I didn't write the person's name down. I wanted to shame them. The spelling in this article is fucking terrible. He went so far as to attend an autograph signing event just to pitch the idea to the Hulkster. I basically waited 5 hours online to get 2 seconds with Hulk Hogan, Rosen told us. I came with an 8x11 glossy picture of Madison Square Garden, and in the picture is our storefront. I walked up to Hulk. I dropped the picture in front of him. Rosen said that he pointed out the bar in the picture and said to Hogan, "That's my storefront, that's the Garden, and you're my new partner." He said that he handed the wrestling superstar his card, and Hogan called him 4 days later. They plan to open the sports bar, which will have 3 floors, including a rooftop bar, in the fall. Rosen says that Hogan doesn't have a direct ownership stake in the project, and that the deal is licensing... Again, the deal is licensing pact. There's a word missing that allows the bar to use his famous... Okay, hold on a second here. Hold on a second. I need to know who wrote this. I need to know who wrote this so I can shame them. This is just awful. This is awful. Hulk Hogan bar, New York Post. Here we go. Page 6. Ollie Coleman. He has also written for The New Yorker and Vanity Fair, and he had a gossip column in the New York Daily News from 2013 to 2016. He studied philosophy and politics at the University of Manchester, England, to mixed reviews. The hell does that mean? In the fall of 2017, Coleman kept an anxious nation abreast of the up-to-the-minute details in the saga of Martha Stewart's missing pie dish, from its disappearance to its safe return, and he was the only journalist in the entire world to cover that one time Jill Zarin accidentally missed a payment on a Rite Aid that she owns in Ohio. He also doesn't like pets. This is what we're dealing with here. He's the deputy editor of Page 6. But it's the Post, so I'm not surprised. As far as Hogan goes, obviously, this being a licensing deal, it's easy money for him. He doesn't have to run anything. He could just license his name and likeness. What's the over-under on how long this thing is going to last? I say 2 years before this thing closes. I mean, when you consider the cost of rent in that area, I don't think this is going to last long. But I'll tell you what, when this thing opens, I may have to go check it out for myself. I may have to go check this thing out for myself. You can be sure of one thing, though. If someone's opening up a bar, Ric Flair will find himself there at some point. Maybe, you know what this great photo opportunity would be? If Flair ever visits that bar, they're going to have Hogan's Greatest Hits, right? Playing 24/7 on the screens. Got to get a shot of Flair just drunk as a skunk, sitting at the bar, looking up. And on the TV, they're showing that one WCW match where Flair wasn't even in the match. I think it was Hogan against Vader in like a strap match. And I think Flair was dressed up as a woman. And Hogan ended up beating Flair. Like one of the more embarrassing moments of his career. Just Flair, drink in hand, looking up at the screen, sitting in Hogan's bar, watching this absolute absurdity. Oh, man. Anyway, in other Hogan news, tickets for he and Eric Bischoff's new Real American Freestyle project are not selling well. They are preparing to host their inaugural event on August 30th in Cleveland at the Wolstein Center on the campus of Cleveland State University. Now, there's still 2 months to go, but the early numbers do not inspire a lot of confidence. According to WrestleTix, in a venue with a capacity of over 13,000, they have set the show up for only 3,800. Of those 3,800 available seats, they have distributed, and I say distributed, not necessarily sold, a grand total of 380 tickets.
When it comes crashing down, and there's no one inside.
There may be more people inside Hogan's new bar than there will be at this Real American Freestyle show. The cheapest ticket to get in is around $40. They're going to have to lower that. But that might not even make much of a difference. How long before they panic and start adding pro wrestling elements to the show? Too bad Mean Gene's not around anymore. He can't go out there to introduce Hogan, so Hogan can come out and cut a promo. All right, let's take some mailbag questions and get on out of here. If you have questions for me, the place to email me is thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. I got an email from Jared in Orlando, Florida, who's been a listener for 12 years. So it's not a question, but I wanted to share that I work as an EMT in the emergency department of a hospital. One of the patients I had was wearing a Cody Rhodes hat, so we began talking about wrestling. Come to find out, he too is a sound-off listener. So Keith, if you're hearing this, it was good talking to you about wrestling, and I hope you are feeling better, my friend. How about that? Yeah, shout out to Keith. I hope you're doing well. Thank you, Jared. Stuart from Paisley, Scotland. Big fan of the show. My 16-month-old, Austin, now listens to you too. Also, a funny sidebar I forgot to share years ago. My brother was my best man at my wedding in 2021, and you got a mention in his speech. Moaned about how when I lived at home, I used to wake him up listening to your podcast, quote, The American Wrestling Solomonster. I think he even listens to you now. Wait a minute. The American Wrestling Solomonster. Is there another Solomonster that I'm unaware of? Is there a Canadian Solomonster? Is there an Australian Solomonster? I love that. He says, I have some thoughts on this Rollins and Punk situation. Apologies for the long message. Just curious on your opinion because I feel like I'm missing something. Since CM Punk has been back, he's had major feuds with Drew McIntyre, Roman Reigns, John Cena, and Seth Rollins. I would personally say Rollins is the weaker of all the feuds, yet he's managed to get involved in every rivalry and I would say add nothing. Breaking down the reasons for the feud, Drew, Punk hated him because he injured him. Reigns, Paul Heyman element in helping the bloodline at War Games. Cena, generational feud. Rollins, he just doesn't like him because he left? I feel like I'm missing something. What is the great appeal about this feud? Why have we been subjected to it for what feels like years? Matches, promos, and actual base for feuds are all poor. While I'm on Rollins, he's got serious go-away heat with me now. His promos are all the same. His outfits and laugh are cringe. His matches, for me anyway, are stale. And the music, ugh, turns my stomach. His current character doesn't make sense either. I know it's early, but I feel like he's even brought Bron Breakker down. Bron was carving out something like a Goldberg type with his own goals. Now he's just relegated to a one-dimensional henchman role who barks for Rollins. He's now just the very early days of Batista in Evolution. I think he would be better with just Heyman. Rollins' character doesn't even make sense. The whole basis for hating Punk is that to beat him and save wrestling because he left and to stop him from doing it again. Well, he won at WrestleMania and Punk got a title match before him. His goal is to save wrestling, so why is he not laser-focused on John Cena, who outright wants to ruin wrestling and leave with the belt? This is a long way to say I think Rollins is actively bringing down the feuds at the moment. He doesn't work for the same reason the Cena heel turn has been stale. No character evolution and no clear focus or rationale. Could be wrong, but what do you think? Yeah, I made the comment, was it yesterday or Friday? It might have been Friday. On the SmackDown stream, whatever it was that we were discussing. And I said that the thing with Seth Rollins leading a faction, it's become clear to me, is he's not the guy to lead a faction. Like, he's not the guy that you build everything around. He's not. They've tried with him before. Rollins is great, and Rollins can go out there and have great matches. He's great in his own way, but he's not that guy. I think that's part of the problem. I see what you're saying about Breakker. I think that will change. I think in the end it'll all be good for Braun. I do think he's in the Batista and Evolution role. I think he'll have his breakout moment at some point, I hope. But you're not wrong. I mean, look, Bron Breakker was starting to really develop on his own. I love the idea of Paul Heyman being with him, but so far what we've gotten out of him is he comes out there in his black suit. He's dressed exactly the same way that Bronson Reed is. They come out there, they look like a couple of Secret Service agents. He barks. He doesn't really talk. I mean, he'll talk shit during his matches, but it's not like he's gotten promo time or any sort of character development in the last 2 months. He barks like a dog. Woof. That's what he does. And it does feel like the longer that goes on for, it might stifle his growth on the roster. So I still think we have to give it some time. It's only been 2 months, 2.5 months, but I don't disagree with you on that. As far as, you know, Rollins feuding with Punk and why are they feuding and what's the real rationale for it? I mean, it goes back to heat that Rollins had with him from when he left WWE and didn't interact with anybody, kind of cut everybody off. I mean, he articulated this in their promos that led up to their first match. I think it was the first match or the cage match, whichever one it was. And I'm with you. I mean, it's going to be July 1st. This week. And based on what they did yesterday at Night of Champions, right now, it looks like we're headed for another Punk and Rollins match, possibly at SummerSlam. And it's like, I don't know that there really is enough juice left in that orange to squeeze out. I feel like it's been done and it's time to move on from this. So I think you make some good points there. I would not, again, give up on Bron Breakker just yet and say that this is all going to be an epic fail, but things will have to change and evolve as time goes on. If they don't, I don't see how that's really going to benefit him in the end. Kevin from Washington, D.C. I went back and did a retrospect on Seth Rollins' career post-Shield, and I realized something. Each time he's been a heel, he's had someone as his lackey behind him every time he was a heel. J&J Security in 2014, Authors of Pain at the end of 2019, Buddy Matthews and Austin Theory in 2020, and now Bron Breakker and Bronson Reed. Because I feel this story has been so repetitive, do you believe that he can be a top heel on his own? Well, that just goes to what I was just talking about. Leading a faction, I don't think so. I don't think that's a great role for him to be in. I don't think he can carry it, you know, in the way that Roman did. Roman just had a certain, I hate using this word, but a certain aura about him that Rollins just doesn't have. Can he be a top heel on his own? I think he could be. I think him and Heyman, if you strip away Breakker and Reed, if it was just Rollins and Heyman, I think that could work. Him being a top heel with like a manager. I think that could work. Him as a heel on his own, can he be like the top heel? I don't think so. I don't think he would have the same success that some of the other top heels over the years have had. I don't think so. Just don't think he's that guy. Roderick from Baltimore, what do you think about WWE or any pro wrestling organization one day inducting Chris Nowinski into their Hall of Fame? I'm not sure that he would qualify for the Warrior Award, but I feel like his continued research and work into concussions and CTE should be commended, as it forced pro wrestling as a whole to elevate their level of seriousness towards head injuries, including cracking down on chair shots to the head. Such elevation and attention could extend careers or, more importantly, save lives. I don't even think they're doing the Warrior Award at all anymore. Ever since Dana Warrior got let go, I don't think they've done a single Warrior Award since then at the Hall of Fame. So as a Warrior Award recipient, no, because I think that's done. To induct him into the Hall of Fame, I don't even know if he would want to accept something like that. It would be, I don't know, it'd be kind of weird. I do think that, he deserves a lot of praise for the work that he's done since leaving WWE and kind of embarking on the journey that his own concussion led him to. So if they wanted to honor him at the Hall of Fame, I mean, I'm not going to object. Is it something that they should do? Is it something I would do? No. But if they do it, cool. You know, it shines a light on an important topic. I wouldn't put him in the Hall of Fame for that reason. You know, like, we're inducting Chris Nowinski because before Chris Nowinski came along and the Concussion Legacy Institute, we didn't give two shits about concussions. And it took Chris coming along to wake us up. Like, I don't know. I don't know that I see that happening. Dave from Chicago. With the 2026 Royal Rumble being held in Saudi Arabia, what are your thoughts on the women wearing bodysuits during the Rumble match? How will the viewer decipher who the wrestlers are? Do you think they will have to get creative with their attire to stand out? Thank you for your time and help. I purchased one of your mother's books as a gift for my niece. Thank you, Dave. I love hearing that. TheSolomonster.com for anyone looking for a link to the book. It's on the very bottom. As far as the Rumble next year, how will they decipher who the wrestlers are? I ask myself that question every year when their theme music hits. Because Def Rebel is so fucking terrible. Yeah, I mean, they're just going to have to distinguish themselves in some other way. I mean, with their makeup or some sort of something they could put over the bodysuit. I don't know. They're going to have maybe they're gonna get Rob Van Dam's designer to airbrush designs onto them. I have no idea. I don't know. They're going to have to work that out. I don't know exactly what they're going to do, but that would be the most sensible thing to me. Jacob from McAllen, Texas. Is yeet going to become the new sarcastic crowd chant in the future, just like what? No. The what chant will still be the sarcastic crowd chant 20 years from now that the what chant is today. Yeet is a Jey Uso thing. I don't see it translating to other people or replacing the what chant. The what chant, unfortunately, will be here long after you and I are gone. Jose from New York City. Who would be your Mount Rushmore of the best real brother tag teams in wrestling? For me, I choose the Hardy Boys, the Young Bucks, the Usos, and the Briscoe Brothers. Mount Rushmore of real brother teams. You know, it's hard not to consider Terry and Dory Funk or Jack and Jerry Briscoe, right? Legendary teams, found success in multiple promotions, held multiple tag team titles. but they found their success as teams before I was even born. So I have no personal connection to those teams. So on my Mount Rushmore, I would have the Steiner Brothers. You got to have them on there. I would have the Hardys, for sure. I would have the Usos. And I would have the Young Bucks. Especially for their overall impact on the business. Like the run they had in Japan, the formation of AEW. You know, that's to say nothing of all the titles that they've won in different places that they've worked. I feel like they have to be on there. Will, from Anaheim, California. I was randomly thinking of Shawn Michaels' best matches the other day, and I started remembering all of the great matches that we missed out on, either due to his first retirement or other circumstances. Buy, sell, and rent between these three matchups that we missed. Shawn Michaels against Sting, Shawn Michaels against The Rock, Shawn Michaels against Eddie Guerrero. All fine choices. I rank them in this way. I have Shawn Michaels and The Rock at number one. I'm buying on that. I'm going to rent on Shawn Michaels against Sting. And I'm going to sell on Shawn Michaels against Eddie Guerrero. All three would be awesome matches with these guys in their prime. Shawn and Eddie, I think they would have killed it at a WrestleMania. But in terms of just my personal interest level, you know, with these guys at their peak, that's the order I would put them in. Rock first, Sting second, Eddie third. And finally, Jonathan from Erie, Pennsylvania, sent me a link to a full match from the WCW Vault channel on YouTube. He says, this video popped up on my YouTube page. I have no memory of this, but Michael Buffer absolutely butchers his introduction of Bret Hart. He says he's wearing black with purple and then calls him the Hitman, Bret, evidently with no last name on his cue card. The match was worth the watch just for the nostalgia of it. That reminds me of when WWE brought Buffer in to the Royal Rumble in 2008 at Madison Square Garden. And that was the Rumble that opened with Undertaker in number one and Shawn Michaels in number two. And when Shawn came out, Buffer introduced him as the Heartbreak Kid. And that was it. Apparently that was his name. No Shawn Michaels. It was the Heartbreak Kid. I fucking died. But yeah, I mean, look, Buffer, this is not the first time that Buffer butchered Bret Hart's intro. Okay, there was that one time where he twice called him Bret Hitman Clark. Like, once is bad enough, but he did it again. And they paid this man $25,000 per appearance. Pay me $25,000. I'll happily fuck up your name. Oh, man. Keep sending in those questions. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. I will be live on YouTube this week as I normally am Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown post shows. That includes an earlier stream on Monday since Raw is starting earlier, 6 p.m. Eastern on Netflix. Don't forget. And then Friday is the 4th of July. So I know some of you may not be around. You may be out celebrating, barbecuing. Hopefully not blowing off your fingers with fireworks. I will be here working and watching SmackDown and streaming live when it is over. I will also be live with JD on his channel, episode 101 of Tuesday Night Titans coming up. We just celebrated episode 100. We killed it, our biggest show yet. You guys, man, came out in full support. We had a fun night on Tuesday, and I'm sure it'll be fun again this coming Tuesday. Back next Sunday with you for episode 919. Of the Solomonster Sounds Off. As we roll on into a very busy month of July, a lot of shows coming up, and the summer is heating up. We had a heat wave last week, and it's coming back again. I'm already looking at the forecast. They're showing 90 plus for next weekend. Can't wait. So much fun. You know how they say, oh, let them cook, right? You hear that expression a lot online, let them cook. Yeah, I'll be cooking all right at the end of this week. Not in that way, though. But come to the cookout with me next weekend, 9/19. Be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, have yourselves a happy and safe 4th of July if you are celebrating, and I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend, and of course on YouTube. Until then, let 'em cook.
The Solomonster sounds off.
So Jay took the microphone and you talk about promos that will go down in the annals of history from some of the greatest world champions that we have ever seen. I don't know. I was taken aback by just how amazing this promo was. What would this man have to say about his opponents? He's going into combat tomorrow against John Cena and Logan Paul, but he's going in there against John Cena. Probably the last time he'll ever be in the ring with John Cena at this point. And so Jey Uso gets the microphone. One word, four letters. Yeet. That was his promo. Very good.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solomonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solomonster.